This week, we welcome Adam Fletcher, Chief Information Security Officer at Blackstone, to discuss security challenges, security trends, and the Global Cyber Innovation Summit. In the Leadership and Communication segment, 5 ways to find natural leaders for your team, why rest is essential to high performance, shift to public cloud curbs data center spending, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. How do you use the information from this show to address issues that executives actually care about? TrustedSec is a global information security consulting firm built on cutting-edge attack simulation research that extends those insights to advisory services, including governance, risk, and compliance, PCI, virtual CISO, and MITRE attack framework assessments. TrustedSec helps you translate the types of zeros and ones that you care about to the types of zeros and ones that executives care about. Go to TrustedSec.com/securityweekly. Learn how TrustedSec can become an extension of your team. The question is simple. Have any of the systems on my network been compromised? The answer is harder than it should be. Enter AI Hunter. Active Countermeasures has automated and streamlined techniques used by the best pen testers and threat hunters in the industry to create AI Hunter, a network threat hunting solution that does the first pass of a hunt for you to identify systems that are most likely to be compromised and scores the results on a scale from 0 to 100. You can then research those systems in depth with AI Hunter. Focus your valuable time on the systems that need your expertise with AI Hunter. Sign up for a personal demo today at securityweekly.com/ACM. Security can't solve crucial problems when they have to wade through thousands of alerts a day. With ServiceNow, you can easily prioritize and respond to your most crucial business threats. That way, you can go from overwhelmed to under control. ServiceNow brings security, risk, and IT together on one platform. Learn more at securityweekly.com/ServiceNow.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 125, recorded April 22nd, 2019. I am your host, Matt Alderman, in Colorado, joined by my co-host, Paul Asadorian, in G-Unit Studio.
Hey, Matt. Good to be here.
Yeah, day after Easter. I get to fly out tonight. I'll see you in studio the rest of this week, which will be fun. I'm bringing you a surprise, by the way.
Awesome.
I got to pack my bag because I can't get alcohol on the plane.
Unless I was going to say, hopefully it's something we can drink or smoke on Thursday night.
We're drinking on Thursday night. I'm bringing you a bottle of something that we're going to try out and see if it's something we want to label and have available.
I'm excited.
Yeah. All right. Join your CISO peers at the Global Cyber Innovation Summit May 1st and 2nd at the Sagamore Pendry in Baltimore, Maryland. This is an invitation-only event. Please visit globalcybersummit.org/request-information to request your invitation. You can now submit your suggestions for guests in our recently released guest suggestion form. Go to securityweekly.com/guests and enter your suggestions. All right, let's start with our guest interview. Adam Fletcher is the Chief Information Security Officer at Blackstone. As a security professional with over 18 years of experience, Adam has worked with global security organizations large and small, including McAfee, Nokia, VeriSign, ISS, and Accuvant. Prior to joining Blackstone, Adam led the international security team for Equifax, coordinating a global security program across 14 countries, each with different business, regulatory, and privacy requirements. Adam, welcome to Business Security Weekly. When I did the prep call with you on Thursday, I realized you and I know a lot of the same people. I went out to LinkedIn today. I'm like, wait, 139 mutual connections. You worked at Accuvant after me, which is why I think we probably never met in person. And it's taken us this long to actually, for once, you know, kind of talk. But we have a lot of the same connections.
Yeah, it's a small world, right? But at the same time, you know, it can be big sometimes. And, you know, you connect with people all the time.
Yeah, so give us a little background first into how your career got started on the information security side, but then ultimately how you ended up in the CISO role at Blackstone.
Well, it's been a long journey. I was talking to someone earlier and realized that it's now been about 20 years. So my first job out of college was actually technology consulting with Deloitte. And I was there about 9 months before a friend of mine who had just joined the New York office of a very small security reseller and managed security services provider called Netrex in New York called me up and said, I know you're not happy doing what you're doing. What do you know about IT security, which I think is what we called it at the time? And I said, I don't know anything. And he said, well, it would be a lateral move, salary rise, but we have stock options. And 1999, the bubble hadn't burst yet. So I said, yep, that sounds great. Let's go do it. So I joined this office, which was really the floor of our boss's apartment in Tribeca. And we spent our days reading through the Checkpoint manual with a router, a switch, I think a Sun Netra T1, and a couple of other, you know, different devices on the floor, learning how to install firewalls. Because in 1999, everybody was getting T1s and not everybody had firewalls.
And you spend a lot of time on PhoneBoy's website, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I can't believe that guy's still around.
We had him on the show not that long ago on Paul Security, one of the shows. He's a pretty regular guest, yeah.
Yeah, he was our lifeline back in those days. So I started kind of my cybersecurity career as doing 2-day firewall installs for clients around the country. Parlayed that into bigger and bigger projects. Traveled the world. Was very lucky. Got to live in Brazil on a long term project with Embratel. Got to live in Finland and Helsinki doing a slew of projects for Nokia. Tried my hand at building a managed services business with VeriSign, based out of Geneva in 2002.
So wait, if you were partnered with Nokia, you did IPSO firewall installations then, right?
We did, yeah.
I still have some of those.
What was their VPN device? Crypto Cluster, I think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, their IPSO chassis are still in my server rack to this day.
Have a rack.
Right? It was a great rack mount case.
Absolutely. So really just kind of bigger and bigger. Then, when VeriSign bought the company that I was working with, I ended up coming back to the U.S. A friend of mine had a moonlighting gig with what was then Network Associates in Dallas. I went and slept on his couch, did a little bit of consulting. That turned into a full-time gig. So I was an internal security architect for McAfee for 4 years. Then went back to consulting. Back to consulting at Nokia via Accuvant for a while. Did some really interesting projects. Really, the precursor to Archer Security today was the project that we did at Nokia. And then started kind of working my way up into management and took the Latin America leadership role for Equifax Security back in 2010. Lived in Sao Paulo, Brazil, where I met my wife. Spent some time in Latin America, and then eventually moved up to headquarters and came to Blackstone about 5 years ago as the deputy CISO. Did that for 2.5 years, and then took over in early 2017 when my predecessor left.
Yeah, to create something called Clear Sky, right? It was Jay, right? You were working with Jay, yeah.
Yeah, Jay Leak, helped kind of rebuild the cybersecurity program at Blackstone 6 or 7 years ago now. And the CISO role here at Blackstone is actually fairly unique, and it's got three pieces to it. And one is to be the CISO of Blackstone, obviously the most important part of the role. But the other two pieces are one, to kind of be a de facto community leader to Blackstone's portfolio of companies, a number of which have CISOs or security leaders. And under this umbrella of Blackstone's ownership or controlling interest, we collaborate and share best practices, commiserate on challenges that we're facing, and that's a really great, kind of closed community that we have to up the level of sharing, across the cybersecurity industry. The other thing that we started doing 5 or 6 years ago was to identify early stage cybersecurity companies that were disruptive in the marketplace and had, you know, solutions that were not just a better mousetrap, but a completely new way of catching mice. And when we do that, when we find one of those early stage companies that's disruptive in the marketplace, that's a great fit for Blackstone, and you know, we think, you know, some of the portfolio would actually adopt as well, then we will actually become investors. So off of Blackstone's balance sheet, not a large amount of money, but enough to be strategic, both as a customer and an investor to those companies. And some of the ones that we've been successful with, you know, over the years are Carbon Black and Silence and Red Owl Analytics. And we helped found CyberGRX and Veridin and Inky and Insights and Preempt. And so we've been very busy, you know, identifying those great new technologies. And it was something that Jay was really passionate about. And he had an opportunity to go and help found Clear Sky Security to go and do cybersecurity investing full time, which created an opportunity for me to be the CISO of Blackstone.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting is you, because of those three kind of purviews, right? You have your internal challenges within Blackstone. You are working with your investment portfolio, and you're also helping, I would imagine, a number of potential startups coming into the security space. I mean, you see lots of challenges across the security industry landscape. Let's start there a little bit and kind of dig in a little bit of what are some of those kind of key challenges you're seeing, not only internally, but maybe across that portfolio as you look around?
Yeah, so I think of the portfolio really as a microcosm of the broader security industry. I mean, we have over 200 portfolio companies across all verticals, all sizes, you know, and yet when you look at it holistically, you know, they're facing and we're facing the same types of challenges that the broader community as a whole is facing. You know, I think that statistically, you know, we're still dealing with, you know, 95% of successful breaches starting with a phishing email. And whether it's phishing or social engineering or business email compromise, you know, whatever technique is being used, those things are, you know, really things that we're all still struggling with because the technologies are just not keeping up with the improvements in attacks, and phishing emails continue to get through. And as you know, we've done a better and better job of training and educating our employees on what to look for. You know, we continue to find that curiosity and context and timeliness, you know, will still make a good lure that much better. And most people will click, right? So, you know, I think there's a shift now in trying to focus on education, but realize that, you know, education is not going to solve the problem the way that we thought it was a few years ago. And we need to go back to technologies and tools that are going to help us reduce the risk either before the fish gets through or after the fish gets through and someone clicks on a link, opens an attachment, enters their credentials, et cetera. So that's one of the big challenges, you know, that we see. Another one is everyone's moving to the cloud. You know, and this is where I think the not just the talent gap that's a broader issue for cybersecurity, but the talent gap plus the newness of the technology, you know, creates this kind of vortex where we can't hire security architects for the cloud. We can't hire, you know, security engineers for the cloud fast enough. People don't have the skills. So we have to figure out how do we upskill our teams in place, you know, to prepare for these moves to infrastructure as a service or software as a service and really, you know, take advantage of the opportunity to set the guardrails and the configurations early before mistakes are made and, you know, and damage can be done. I think those are two of the bigger ones that I see.
So I want to push on the phishing one for a little bit because we've seen this for a while, right? We know that a well-crafted phishing email comes in. Does that mean cyber hygiene and patching and the ability to keep your systems up to date is still one of those just base tenets we're not doing very well in the industry? So my question is it really more innovation there, or is it just doing some of the basics? I'm curious your thoughts on sure. those two angles.
Well, I think there's a combination here. So one, you know, on doing more of the basics, you know, I think that defense in depth, you know, which is it seems to have gone out of favor as terminology that we use, you know, is still absolutely critical in phishing defense because, you know, when I think about it, a phishing email does get through and an employee clicks on a link, then, you know, I'm looking to have good endpoint, you know, preventative technology that's going to, you know, block malware if it's malware embedded in a detachment. Or if it's a link and they go to, you know, a website, well, ideally, you know, either a proxy or a firewall with, you know, good threat intelligence would prevent the user from even getting to that website. But supposing they do, and they either enter credentials or they download additional malicious software, you know, I want controls in place to reduce the blast radius or reduce the impact, minimize the impact of that happening as well. So, you know, even though I've trained this user and I'm hoping that they don't click or open the attachment until it's been investigated and confirmed safe, these layers of defense, you know, are still really important. And then in the, you know, to get back to your original question, on the off chance that all of this stuff fails and something does get through and it's something that can exploit a vulnerability like MS, you know, 1117, which was WannaCry and NotPetya, you know, then we should have patched for that, right? Or, you know, in the case of NotPetya, which spread, you know, from workstation to workstation over ports that most employees don't need to use for daily communication, we probably should have blocked those. And we can block those using group policy and Windows firewall. So there absolutely is a very basic element of hygiene to this, you know, that a lot of companies don't do a great job with. To the second part of the question, you know, innovation in phishing technology, yeah, I think it's still really important. And, you know, we see, you know, companies come into the marketplace all the time that are, you know, hoping to be a better mousetrap when it comes to preventing phishing emails. The one that we've partnered with, Inky, you know, has a new technique, you know, to identify whether or not, you know, an image is the legitimate image from that company versus, you know, a copy of that image that's slightly off and is probably being used by attackers, right? So that's another, you know, way that we have to keep up with the latest techniques being used by attackers to try and prevent as much as we can and then rely on detection and response when prevention isn't possible.
Adam, I truly believe that we're very concerned about email phishing today, and I've already started to see the shift go outside of email. And I feel like as we build more protections into email phishing and even browsers, that the attackers are going to shift probably ahead of us and move to other technologies. Have you seen many startups start to tackle this newer problem that I think is going to become a huge problem in the enterprise?
I haven't seen a ton of it in terms of, you know, phishing, whether it's SMS based or, you know, other messaging systems or social media. You know, we tend to see a pretty small amount percentage wise of other types of phishing and social engineering. You know, I think strictly because there's still this perception that everybody is on email all the time. So, you know, in the same way that, you know, malware writers write malware mostly for Windows, I think phishers are phishing mostly with email, right? That's where the money is, at least the bulk of it. So until we see some sort of seismic shift in how people are communicating, you know, I think we'll continue to see that in email.
And so, you know, you've got this portfolio, you talk to your peers all the time. You know, I want to transition a little bit into, you know, how do you as a CISO and your peers, you know, where do you go to collaborate? I want to cover the Global Cyber Innovation Summit a little bit here. You know, how does CISOs work with their peers to really discuss these challenges and then come up with solutions to help solve this across multiple environments, because the use cases are very similar.
Of course they are. And, you know, you probably know, I think cybersecurity is one of the few industries where, for the most part, you know, competition, business competition is irrelevant, right? I have, for example, a pretty tight-knit group of my peers across other private equity and alternative investment organizations. And we talk all the time, you know, whether it's via email or on monthly phone calls, you know, and it gives us the opportunity to ask, you know, what each other is doing with a certain technology or a certain solution. It gives us the opportunity to benchmark against each other. I mean, I think that it's the nature of executive teams, you know, to always want to know what their peers are doing, whether it's for other enterprise risks like legal and compliance, you know, and now cybersecurity is one of those enterprise risks that everybody wants to be kind of, you know, in the group, right? In the broader financial services sense, I'm fortunate to live in New York City and work in New York City. So there's no shortage of industry organizations, both paid and unpaid, you know, that give me an opportunity to collaborate, you know, with my peers. And then there are the bigger conferences, you know, or the summits where people get together, like the Global Cyber Innovation Summit, right, which is intending to, you know, raise the level of dialogue around, you know, problems and solutions and, you know, innovation and technology by bringing some of the best security leaders along with the best security technologists and innovators and CEOs and, you know, and really kind of creating a space where people can talk about the challenges that they're facing, you know, and communicate and collaborate and benchmark with one another and really try and figure out how we get ahead of, you know, what the attackers are doing.
Yeah. Are there specific themes you expect to see at the Global Cyber Innovation Summit in a few weeks? Are there like big kind of thematic areas where you see focus of conversation, discussion, because these are emerging problems that need to be solved?
Yeah, I think there are a couple. You know, cloud security, not surprisingly, is one of them. You know, public-private sharing is one of them. Data provenance, you know, and I think, you know, the idea that we're, and this has been an idea for, I think, a couple of years now, but a data-centric security model, you know, is probably going to be important long-term, especially as the proliferation of data becomes a challenge that CISOs are going to have to deal with more and more frequently. Data science, you know, separating fact from fiction and, you know, and truth from not on AI versus ML, and how we're all going to use data science, you know, as a tool for better cybersecurity, you know, and really, you know, what to expect, you know, when communicating with, you know, executives. I think, you know, the seismic shift, you know, in how my job is perceived over the last few years, you know, has been that cybersecurity is now on the front page of the newspapers that our executive teams read. You used to have to seek out cybersecurity news, or every now and then you would see something in the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times or the New York Times. And now it's an almost everyday occurrence, you know, in the papers, on the internet sites, and sometimes even on the morning news shows. So, you know, how do we adequately communicate with, you know, our executive teams so that they have confidence that we know what good looks like. You know, we're testing to see if we're good. We're benchmarking, you know, with our peers, and, you know, we're running programs that are continuously improving, you know, such that they feel like we're doing a good job. And we are doing a good job, right?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the challenges, right, for you in the role as a CISO is understanding how to communicate the potential threats out there from a security perspective in a set of business terms that your executive team understands, right? Like loss of revenue or reputational damage or those sorts of things. Any tips or tricks for your fellow CISOs on some of the things that have helped you with that communication to the executive team?
Yeah. Ask questions first and then listen. You know, I don't presume to know, everything about, you know, the business. I mean, I've been here 5 years and I'm still learning every day. You know, asking questions like what's important to you, right? You know, the simple, you know, question of for all time now, you know, what keeps you up at night? When you get an opportunity to talk to, you know, executives who are decision makers, you know, higher up in the organization, and you ask them, you know, what are they concerned about, right? Don't presume to know what is the most important thing from their perspective, right? What you think might be the most impactful to the business if a cybersecurity incident were to occur may not be the thing that they think is most impactful. And, you know, when you have that discussion with them and when you listen to them, you know, you might get a different perspective on, you know, how the cybersecurity program should look. And as a CISO, you know, it's really important to be able to adapt to that and to adjust the parameters of both people and process and adapt technology to support those, you know, so that the program is right sized for your organization.
Yeah. And I think over time, as we continue, you know, to your point, the trend of shifting to the cloud, embracing DevOps, these are all some of these factors that you have to adjust to, but understanding what that means from a business context perspective as well.
Yeah. And I also think that context probably doesn't change all that much, you know, and neither do the fundamentals of cybersecurity. You know, what changes is the techniques that you use to deploy preventative controls or to deploy detection, you know, or to run an incident response playbook using the technologies that are now available in the cloud, whether they're native or deployed off-the-shelf technologies. You kind of have to adapt to that. But fundamentally, a lot of the processes and procedures are very similar. You need good identity and access management. You need, you know, to follow a least privilege model. You need to set guardrails in place so that, you know, you can enable freedom of action for the business, you know, but not, you know, create a scenario where they're taking or bringing risk, you know, that's uncontrolled, right?
Yep. Yeah, agreed. Paul, any additional questions for Adam while we have him?
No, I'm good.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Please join Adam and other CISOs at the Global Cyber Innovation Summit by visiting globalcybersummit.org/request-information to request your invitation. We'll take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Let the team at Black Hills Information Security test your defenses. With over 10 years of experience in penetration testing, red teaming, and threat hunting, the testers at Black Hills will help you find the holes in your security before the bad guys do. The team at Black Hills cares about educating and sharing their knowledge by creating countless blogs, open source tools, and webcasts for you to learn more about the tradecraft of pen testing and red teaming. Visit securityweekly.com/BHIS to join their mailing list and view the latest blogs and webcasts from Black Hills Information Security. The modern attack surface is vast and permeable, extending from the data center to the cloud and device edge. Security teams are stretched thinner and thinner as they try to cover this ground. The result? More high-profile breaches hit the news every day. Don't let your organization be next. ExtraHop delivers security from the inside out, helping enterprise security teams detect threats up to 95% faster and cut staff time to resolve by 2/3 or more. Act with confidence. Learn more at extrahop.com/securityweekly. Major data security breaches continue to make headlines. Are you prepared? Standardizing your security framework will help you stay competitive, be a reliable business partner, and manage intellectual property, financials, and employee and customer information. The American National Standards Institute, or ANSI, offers the standards you need in one place through standard subscriptions, a cost-saving, fully customizable solution. Sign up for your free trial at securityweekly.com/ANSI.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian. We've heard from our listeners that they love our content, but the amount of content we distribute can sometimes be a little overwhelming. We've recently released our customizable listener interest list. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe and click the button to join the listener list and let us know your interests. Also, register for our upcoming webcast with ServiceNow by going to securityweekly.com/webcasts. If you've missed any of our previously recorded webcasts, you can find them at securityweekly.com/on-demand. All right, let's get into the leadership articles for this week. Yes. And I wanted to start with 5 ways to find natural leaders for your team.
We need to do that.
Yes. Well, that's why I brought this one up, because I was like, oh, you know, we're in the middle of looking for a developer and doing some hiring.
Hear that, folks? Like, we are looking to hire a developer. So jobs@securityweekly.com is the email address.
Yeah. If you want to have fun like Paul and I get to have every day in this great environment, then come on, join us. We got some stuff to do. But this is a great little article to talk about how to find leaders, not only externally, but also internally. If you're looking to who are going to be the natural leaders in your environment. And they break down these 5, and I thought each one was kind of interesting to talk through a little bit. We'll spend a little extra time here because I think this is crucial for companies to find good leaders to help grow the team and to grow your overall skills in an organization. So the first one was look for people with signs of high emotional intelligence.
Now, Matt, what is emotional intelligence?
It's the ability to identify how people kind of feel. It's that empathy side of the equation, right? So as you're looking for a leader, it's not just about intelligence, but it's also about understanding what's deemed here emotional intelligence. And that is you understand how the rest of your team feels and you adjust your leadership according to the needs of the team because you're empathic.
Hopefully our team agrees that we do a pretty good job of that, I think.
We try.
Yeah, so we get it right 100% of the time. But yeah, like if we see people struggling, we help. We get them the resources they need. And we know when to like back off and stay out of the way, as the article described. I think that's a good, at least a very good example of 2 scenarios where your emotional intelligence comes into play. Sometimes you got to jump in and help, but sometimes you got to let them do their thing. And you don't want to mix the two up, right? Because I think that's where most leaders get into trouble and jumping in and helping when like that's not what needed to be done at that moment.
Exactly. And so understanding those situations and then applying the right decisions about help or not help is something that you should look for. And that creates a really good leader because they're looking out for the entire team and they're there to coach the team at various points in their career and personal life. I mean, aspects of this is also personal because there's a lot of external pressures, you know, your employees will get, your team gets as well, and understanding what's business related, what's personal related, which boundaries should you and shouldn't you cross are also very important there.
True.
The second one I love because I agree with this one, look for brilliant communication skills. And this is something we see a lot of great leaders have great communication skills. They do. They know how to communicate up and down the organization. And if you're looking for natural leaders in your organization, look for people that have great communication skills because it is, I wouldn't say it's a dying skill, but if you look at where our social behaviors are going, we're less and less verbally written communicative, right? We interact a lot more on social media and other things, and good communication skills have their place and will continue to have their place on your leadership team.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to folks about hiring developers as we've, just recently opened up a position for one. And, you know, they tell me stories about you can have some really brilliant software developers. However, they lack some of those communication skills and they'll talk to users and use, terms like REST API or whatever. I say that because you had an article in there about REST, and I thought we were going to talk about XML versus JSON, but it's actually about actual REST, not REST APIs. But talking to the user is one thing, and then they said, this person wants to move up in the organization, but you know, they're in a meeting and they're on their phone texting or whatever during the meeting, and that was observed by others. And I think that really all kind of ties into communication skills.
The other thing that's important with this developer specific example is think about the requirements you're trying to articulate mm-hmm. to the developer understanding those, to be able to ask questions and mm-hmm. understand, did they understand it correctly, and be able to communicate back so that code is actually getting developed the way you want it to get developed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's big.
Very big. Number three is big potential, which is don't always judge a leader by their past. Mm-hmm. Look at what they could potentially do in the future. Now, obviously, you look at past performance as an indicator, but it's not the only indicator when looking for natural leaders. If you believe somebody has big potential and they just need to be given the opportunity, that is a way to identify natural leaders in your organization as well.
Yeah, and I was reading an article that talked about frustrations during the interview process, and one of the things it said that I thought was good general advice were questions during the interview process. If you're, like in our case, the employer, I'm asking the questions of the interviewee, is to ask questions about their past, Matt, and not, like, in this hypothetical situation, what would you do, right? Try and say, you know, have you run into this situation before? And if they have, well, how did you handle it, right? And have them talk about their skills and experiences that they bring to the table. And that doesn't necessarily have to relate precisely to the job. Like, you know, we list Python, but I'm like, if you know, you can probably learn it, right? It's not necessarily what we're looking for. It's a plus, but, you know, when faced with a certain situation, how did you handle it in the past, regardless of what technology platform it was on? So I think in general, we get too hung up on what would you do and what specific skill sets do you have with technology, when it should be more about asking them, how did you handle these various scenarios that were you encountered during your career or in your life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that helps you understand, do they have potential to do something outside of maybe what their past experience has been, because they can adapt and grow and do more for you.
Yep, absolutely. That and asking about specific skill sets, especially in security, is going to give you very few what you've defined as qualified candidates, in my opinion.
Yeah. Number four, doers, not watchers. And I'm a big believer in this, right? Is you want to see initiative. You want to see people really out doing the work, right? They see a problem, they're out trying to solve it. They're very active. They're not sitting back watching to see what other people do. Good leaders are doers. They're just going to take the reins and they're going to go. They're not going to sit back and watch.
I think with John Strand and I were talking, and he's like, you know, I enable my team to do stuff because sometimes they feel like they're afraid to do stuff because they're going to make a mistake. And he's like, as long as you did something and you applied some kind of common sense to it, he's like, we're all good, right? So no harm, no foul. If you're trying stuff, taking initiative, applying some good common sense, you're not burning the infrastructure to the ground, right? You're mindful of that. When you make a mistake, that's okay. We all make mistakes. But having initiative is more important than, I think, the safer person that doesn't want to do anything because they're afraid to make a mistake, as an example.
Right, which ties into our last one, which is accountability. We're going to make mistakes. Yep. I've made plenty of mistakes in my career,
sure.
Right?
Me too.
It's realizing that you've made the mistake, you acknowledge it, and then you decide how you're going to learn from it so you don't repeat it, right?
Yep.
So just to your point, you know, the conversations you had, you know, with John, give them initiative. Mm. If they make mistakes, look, own up to it. Yep. If I have accountability for it, then I know that that person's not going to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two, the doer and the accountability, work hand in hand to really identify leaders that, one, have the initiative, realize when they make a mistake, learn from it, and get better for the long haul.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This was a good article.
Anybody
looking for leaders?
I did.
Yeah.
I liked it.
The second article, this is actually one of Jason's that he brought on for last week, but we did the Security Money segment, so we didn't get to this one. And I brought this one in because it's a really interesting correlation between bomb squad experts and business. And there's a couple points in here that I thought were just really interesting to review. The article is called Business Wisdom Learned from Bomb Squad Experts and Their Commanders. And basically what the article talks about are there are three components to a bomb. You have what's the first one? It's called the first component of any explosive device is its power source. Power source in business terms is the role that you're in. And a lot of what you have to think about in an explosive and in business is the power source or the role of the person in the, that has a major impact into how you think about the problem, is because that role and the responsibilities that role has are a very important part. So they tie these different components of the explosive to these different components in an organization, which I thought was interesting. So there's specific questions here. It says, what is the role situation specifically accountable for to ensure repeatable success? What is the precise business purpose of the role, event, or situation? What are the unambiguous boundaries of the role's functional responsibilities? And this question's great because they do it all three times. When was the last time these questions have been asked and by whom?
This one's a real thinker.
Yes. Then they go into the second component and they say, well, the second component of a bomb is circuitry. And in business terms, that is the organization itself and aspects of the organization or the system that you're in, which means aspects of cultural influence and the organization as a whole. Again, walks through these different questions to think about what's the role of the system here and how it will influence the outcome we want. What is the precise business purpose the system we're operating in has here? What are the system's unambiguous boundaries and how it will function here? And then again, when was the last time these questions were asked and by whom? Which leads into the third one, which is the load, the explosive itself in the load. And here they refer to that as the performance capability of a person, right? So role, organization, and then the actual performance capability of that person based on those three and bringing those together. Again, looking at what's the accountable performance needed for success, what will the precise business impact be in performing as needed, what are the unambiguous boundaries surrounding optimal performance, and then when was the last time these questions were asked and by whom? And so it puts these three components of bomb and bomb techs into a corollary into the business terms of the types of questions you should ask about the role, the organization, and the overall performance of that person in that role. It's an interesting way to think about it.
It is. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
And the best line in this article, by the way, is up towards the top. It says, if you see me running, follow me.
Yep. Every great bomb tech, I think, has that t-shirt, right?
Yes. All right, now we're going to get to REST and not REST APIs. Why REST is essential to high performance. I had to bring this article in. As some people know, I grew up in Ohio. I did a first part of my career in Cleveland. I went to school in Cleveland, and this is an interview with LeBron James, who's no longer with the Cavs. He's now in LA, but it talks about the need for high performers to get adequate amount of rest. Now, most people would hear, 7 to 9 hours. This actually talks about some of these athletes, 9-10 hours of rest.
Wow.
A night needed to refuel their body for high performance. But the article talks about this isn't only just a physical need. It's also mental to help with creativity. The mind needs time to rest. And a lot of entrepreneurs, sometimes me included, wouldn't get a lot of rest, right? We're just constantly on the go. This article really talks about how rest is important for the mental state of the person as well as the physical state, and how getting more sleep actually helps with creativity and innovation and some of the other kind of the things we want to see out of our leaders.
Yeah, totally agree. Not always a reality in my world, but I have small kids at home, so that makes it hard, harder, I should say, to get rest. But even just not thinking about it, putting it down for a while, putting your project down for a while is, you know, huge. In fact, the coding project I'm working on, right? Friday, I was stuck on a problem, and I'm like, I'm going to work on other things over the weekend. Came in Monday morning, and within like 20 minutes, I had figured out that particular problem. And so sometimes just stepping away, that was one of the things that when I worked my first job in college in technology, that the support person, Dave, taught me was sometimes you just got to not think about it and come back to it, and then you'll have a fresh perspective on it. And I think rest is a similar kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and it talks about that in this article. It says 4 hours of highly productive work is better than 8 hours yes. of interrupted work, for mm-hmm. example. And how 12-hour workdays aren't really more effective because mm-hmm. you need to take those breaks. You need to walk away from aspects of the work that's in front of you because it gives your mind time to rest, think about the problem maybe a little differently to come back and solve it, to your point, right? And yep. so they talk about how these different day structures also impact aspects of rest, and how sometimes you just you need to take those breaks during the day to give your mind time to catch up and think about things differently.
For sure.
Yeah, that's a good article. I try to get that sleep as much as I can, but it's always hard, and it will be really difficult on a red eye tonight coming yes. into studio, so yes. we'll see how well I think tomorrow. This next article is 4 ways working dads can make more time for family, and I don't want to only, because look, I think there's a lot of working moms out there that this article applies to as well. So I don't want anybody to take it as a one-sided only, because I think there's some really good tips in here, and this is something I've had to learn over the years. I've traveled a lot in my career over the years. When we moved to Colorado in 2004, early on, I had my startup here, which was a spin-out from Accuvant, and I spent a lot of time at work. And then, you know, as my career progressed, I worked for companies that weren't based in Colorado. I was on a lot of airplanes over the years. So, you know, this article is kind of near and dear to my heart a little bit because I've been here. I've gone through this, right? And there's certain things that my wife and I did when I was home to really impact the time at home aspects of my career. And they're summarized in here, and that's why I wanted to bring these up, because I think they're really important for anybody, any parent that works a lot or travels a lot. These are some of the things that have helped me get through this in my career. First one, make time for the little things. And when I mean little things, I mean simply every morning, as Paul knows, my calendar's blocked out because I take my son to school, my youngest. I drive him to the Air Force Academy every morning that I'm home. That's just one of the things I do with him, right? That time in the car is precious. So that's kind of my first start of my day, is I take my son to school. I try to pick him up every night from baseball practice, because now he's in baseball. I try to pick him up after practice. I try to get to every single baseball game when I'm home, right? Those are the little things we're talking about, because they have a huge impact on your relationship with your children. Mm-hmm. And I dedicate and block those times out on my calendar.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You do the same thing.
Yeah. You gotta be involved and use your calendar to block off those little things. All the taking kids to school and driving around, being the chauffeur, right? You know, my boys are involved with all kinds of activities, and I try and, you know, be there and have it on my calendar. You see me leaving early some days, pick my son up from here, drop my son off, you know, other son off there. That's important. Agreed.
Yeah. The other thing I do is when we're home, we always have dinner as a family together. We don't eat at different times. We all eat together. Even if that's 7 o'clock at night.
It's hard when they're little because they don't care about eating.
I know.
It's hard. I think that gets better as your kids get older with dinner time, for sure.
Yeah, mine are older. But, you know, it varies every day. Mm-hmm. Some nights he has baseball, so we'll eat at a normal time. But on a night he's got a baseball game, we may not eat till 7:30, 8 o'clock at night.
Right.
But we'll all get together and eat together. Because
the other thing that I do too is like whenever my son's asked me to like stop what I'm doing and have a lightsaber duel or go play soccer in the yard, I just do it. Right. Like, and I think the article talks about the priority and sense of urgency for things. Right.
Correct.
Whatever you're doing at the time probably can wait and you can go play with your kids. Right. That and I'm a nerd, and you know when they ask me to do things like watch Star Wars or have lightsaber duels, I'm all about it. So,
yeah, and that ties into the second point: know what's truly urgent,
mm-hmm.
and be able to know what's urgent that you need to deal with and what's not urgent. So again, I'm not allowed to have my cell phone at the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
My wife has banned it.
Yep,
don't look.
No electronics.
I'm not allowed to look at the phone. Yeah, because look, if it's urgent, okay. But in most cases, what we do, it can wait. Yep. You know, my wife is a nurse. You know, your wife's in the healthcare space.
Mm-hmm.
They know what urgent is. When somebody's life is on the line,
mm-hmm.
that's urgency. We don't have anything like that on our side
that
is that urgent where we're talking life and death. And mm-hmm. so just understand what's truly urgent, what's not. And those things that aren't urgent, they can wait.
Yep.
They can wait until later when the kids are in bed. They can wait until the next morning sometimes. And it's understanding those.
Yeah, and I think that morning work time is better than night work time, as the article kind of outlines too.
Yep. It talks about setting boundaries. We've talked a little bit about this already. You know, one of my boundaries is no electronics at the dinner table.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you got to set those boundaries and you got to figure those things out, right? I mean, it's hard to raise kids. And when you have working parents, it there's a lot of boundary setting that helps just kind of keep you all focused in aspects of the routines. And it's not only good for you and your spouse, it's good for your kids too.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is set some goals. And we're not talking like work goals, like, okay, I got to, you know, so much in revenue or this, that, and the other thing. But it's little things like, all right, my goal is when we're home, we all have dinner together. That means 7 nights a week, we should be having dinner together. You know, how many baseball games am I going to get to? Practices, whatever those little goals are, set some goals and make sure that you're spending the time with your kids, with the family, with the spouse. It goes a long way. And it's taken, like I said, it took Lauren and I a long time to figure it out.
It took us a
few good years to figure this out.
It's a great point, Matt. This is nothing that you can read an article and like all of a sudden turn things around, in my opinion. It takes a lot of work, a lot of communication, a lot of trial and error too.
It does. And
those things change, right? The kids' schedules change, the wife's schedule change, the work schedule changes, as in my case, changes quite a bit, right? And so you got to be kind of fluid, which is hard. For me, it's especially, I like to know that I'm doing the same thing every week. Hence, Security Weekly has been on a Thursday night for 14 years or whatever, right? But you gotta learn to be flexible.
Yeah, agreed. And you got to work closely with your spouse to do it, because the two of you got to be partners in this. And, mm-hmm. you know, like I said, we figured it out, but it took us a while to get there.
Yeah. And so we're insights into the way things are going at home for me. We're getting ready to put in a new septic tank, it looks like. So my wife and I just keep telling each other, more me telling her, like, we're going to work together on this. There's a lot of things to be done, right, to support this. Some things got to get put on hold. But there's no way one of us could, you know, take on even 80% of this, right? Like, we have to split responsibilities. So I'm going to be working from home for some times, right, while there's excavators driving through my yard and stuff like that.
Ripping up tile and all the fun.
It's a team effort for sure.
Yes, definitely. All right, a couple little technology tidbits in here. Gartner, shift to public cloud curbs data center spending. Now, we've talked about this. We even in the last segment with Adam, right, mm-hmm. moving to the cloud. But what's that impact on budgets? And that's what I thought was pretty interesting in this article. There's some really good metrics in here for anybody who wants to see them. Gartner talks about forecasts that global IT spending will hit $3.79 trillion in 2019. Which is an increase of 1.1%. So the first thing to take away from that is, if you're in the security space, remember, a lot of our budgets are tied to our IT budgets. Mm. And it's usually a fraction of this number. But when you see the increase to 1.1%, that just tells me that IT spending might be getting a little flat here. 1.1% is not a big increase on a year-by-year basis. But in contrast, it predicted a 2.8% decline in spending on data center equipment, which is big, right? As even though spending's going up, data center spending's going down because people are starting to shift assets into the cloud. And this will also have, I think, an impact on security spend, which is where you spending for security solutions. If you're not putting in as much data center equipment, you're not putting in on-premise security solutions to protect that equipment. Right.
Yeah. And so very, I think, you know, yeah, the shift is interesting, but I think expected by many of us, right? And a lot of the newer security companies we're seeing are very much in the cloud. And you have the other article in here about three factors to ensure a successful shift to the cloud. I was just catching up with Cloud Needy, who is a sponsor. Matt and I are advisors. This is a technology, an area that I look at, I'm like, this could really ease, I think, put a lot of people at ease about shifting to the cloud, right? It's going to tell you whether you're in compliance or not when your stuff is in the cloud. It's going to tell you if you've set a way that you're deploying an application or infrastructure to the cloud, that it matches that. And if it doesn't, it's going to tell you about it. The cloud providers, I think, have done a pretty terrible job at giving us that visibility. And when you have vendors like Cloud Needy, they can give you that information. And I think, especially in your initial migration, it's huge. I mean, when I've done IT projects, my biggest question is like, what did I miss, right? Like, what didn't I configure that was there before that needs to be now and might look different? I mean, if that doesn't describe your move to the cloud, it should, right? And having those checks and balances is important.
Yeah, I mean, with the previous article and this one, right, which is the kind of the three steps to cloud migration, I've been telling the investment community for a while because I do a lot of advisory calls for them. I'm like, guys, this is happening. And the reason I brought this article in is because it's the first time someone has actually documented a decline in data center equipment spending. And to me, that's the tip of the iceberg of what is going to transpire over the next few years. And so how do you then, as a security professional, get ready for this continual shift away from on-premise data center equipment into the cloud? And which ties into this next article in the conversation on Cloud Needy is, look, the security walls have shifted. Mm-hmm. Not are they only shifting, they have shifted. And we talk about this move of the perimeter away from the network and how it's moving to the application and the user, because applications and users are no longer inside your four walls as a corporation, and those walls are shifting every day. If you think a traditional firewall is a stopgap control for you, it's not in the long term, because everything's moving outside of the perimeter. So that's one of the points in the second article here. The other one is the cloud will add flexibility, both good and bad. Mm-hmm. I think we have to think about from security professionals. It's great for the development teams to be able to spin up their own stuff, but is it configured correctly? Is it compliant? Is it secure? Yeah, that flexibility is great for your development team and for the business to be agile and move faster. But it puts a lot more burden on the security teams to make sure things are secured and configured correctly.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. And then the last one is, on the cloud, you can scale up. Again, good and bad.
Cost-wise, could be bad, which is why there's companies like Cloud Checker and the like to give you a handle on your costs.
Exactly right. And that's why I think not only will you see a continual move to the cloud, but I think you will see a continual cloud move not only to infrastructure as a service, but ultimately to platform as a service, where you are less and less reliant on the underlying infrastructure yourself, and you're leveraging a platform because the cost dynamics are better there. And you don't have to worry about managing the individual infrastructure, which is why I see this abstraction of the network and the endpoint continuing, moving more to the user and the application, because we're going to be deploying these applications on platforms, not on dedicated infrastructure in the cloud anymore.
Yep. Sweet.
So some good tips. All right. That's our articles for the week. So I want to thank everybody for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.